Welcome to Emerging Sounds of the Bizarre live from Loughborough. What are we doing in Loughborough, you ask? We're in a university where the JISC Users and Innovation Programme is staging a two-day conference on next-generation technologies in practice. The conference features presentations by many of the Users and Innovation Programme projects, and we're featuring people from some of those projects on the programme tonight. My name's Graham Atwell, and I'll tell you more about the people on the lineup in a moment. Tonight, I'm delighted to be joined by my co-host, Josie Fraser. Now, Josie's not just quite made it here yet, but she's on her way, or so I'm told. Now, back to that lineup. First up will be George Roberts, who's going to be talking about the Emerge Project, sustainable communities of practice, open space technologies, and that kind of thing. And then I'm going to interview Mark Van Homelin about PLEs, and specifically the Manchester personal learning environment that he's presented at the conference. Bob Rotherham's going to tell us about the Sounds Good project, looking at the use of audio for giving feedback to students on their work. Hey, and here's Josie. Hey, Josie, glad you could make it. You heard that bit? Who else we got on the programme tonight?
We should have Nicola Whitten and Rosie Jones. I'm not sure where we'll find them, but I'm sure we will find them.
We're hoping they're going to be in the bar later.
They're quite elusive. I guess that's because they work in alternative reality gaming. So maybe they'll leave clues.
Maybe indeed. We'll be having to chase the clues. Fabulous project. We played it last week at the Evolve event in Manchester. And I think my team came last, I think. But there you go.
My team came third, but I did almost cry. Because it was so hard, it wasn't very easy at all.
It wasn't easy at all, but it's a fabulous project. Okay then, well, we've got great people lined up. I think we're going to go into a musical break now. We've got Joe Rosso as well, who's manning the machine. We've got a bit of a rigged up outfit here. We're running it all from a laptop with a rather small screen.
Hi, Joe.
But Joe's grinning us. And of course, we've got Dirk Stierglitz, who's in Bremen, giving us feedback by Skype.
Hi, Dirk.
Okay, into the musical break, Joe, and then we'll be back with George Roberts. The Misfits at Joe's bar. They're drinking non-stop. Some whiskey.
And here we are back after that lovely musical interlude. And I've got George Roberts here with me. George is the director of the Emerge Project.
Hello, Josie.
Oh, it's great to see you again. We missed you last week in Salford.
I missed it too. I heard it was a great event. I like taking part in these emerging radio programs. You know, from the appreciative inquiry interviews that have been done, one of the things that the community appreciated most about the Emerge projects was the live radio shows that we did and then podcast and made available as one of the outputs. So it's been a popular show.
It's great to get the whole community along here with us for all of the people that couldn't attend. And for all the lazy people, they can catch up with us in their own time. So, George, today we're here for 2 days in lovely sunny Loughborough at the Next Generation Technologies in Practice Conference. We're on day one today. It's been a jam-packed day. Do you want to tell our listeners a little bit about why we are here, what we've been doing today?
Yes, the Next Generation Technologies in Practice Conference has two broad aims. The first day is as much a celebration of the conclusion of the Users and Innovation Program, a conclusion of the Emerge Project and everything that's been going on there. So it's about bringing things to an end and then looking at the questions of sustainability. The second day is more an outward-facing day, where the aim is to showcase the outputs of the projects to the wider community of stakeholders in institutions who are interested in the way that educational technology research and development projects can help sustain organizational or institutional change.
So it's kind of a historic event, really. It's a sad event, really. I know that we'll all be working in different projects. We'll all be going on. We've all met some fantastic new partners and friends. But the Emerge project's coming to the end.
Yes, it is. It's a bittersweet occasion. The Emerge project has had some challenges, of course, but I think on balance, it's been one of the, well, certainly it's one of the best things that I've had the honor, pleasure, and opportunity to be associated with. I think we've seen some really positive project development that could well lead to some institutional change. It's certainly leading to changes in the way people conceive of doing educational development projects. So whether that change then translates into wider institutional change or not, it's hard to say, but it's certainly a question worth asking.
And it's definitely a very significant project in terms of UK research methodologies and focuses, especially with regard to Web 2 technologies.
Yes, with regards to Web 2 technologies, the project has emphasized not that it is not only the technologies. The thing about Web 2 technologies is that they emphasize the human networks. I suppose everybody does know that the Emerge project and the Users and Innovation program was founded on the idea of user engagement and a user engagement model. Now, user engagement is sometimes conflated with the problems of interface design. A user-centered approach to educational software development is not just about interface design, no matter how important that may be, and of course it is very important. It's about working together with people. And human networks are rather more complex than even the most complex software system.
Okay, and I guess many people are waiting with bated breath to see the output reports from the Just Emerge community and actually see how the team have managed to support and facilitate a community using Web2 tools and practices.
Well, you can get a taste of the outputs from that on the Emerge Reports site. If you go to the Emerge home website, http://jiskemerge.org.uk, then you'll see a link on the right-hand side of the page to Emerge Reports. Click there and you'll find quite a number of challenging and synthesis reports that make challenging reading for the institutions involved in higher education in the UK.
Challenging and enjoyable reading though there, George.
Challenging and enjoyable reading, by all means.
Okay. We've got a question come in this moment from one of our listeners. What ideas of institutional change do you suggest? It's a bit of a broad strokes question there for you, George.
Well, here's one I prepared earlier. I think there are two questions that institutions need to be asked of institutions. And that's, first, the extent to which institutions are willing to cede a certain amount of control to individuals in the organizing and planning, operating of their educational practice. The second question that institutions need to face is that of to what extent do they, as existing communities, cede control to new communities. So the Emerge community is, in effect, a new community that it poses a question to the existing institutions such as the JISC. Finally, for individuals, the question is, to what extent does an individual subordinate their autonomy and self-direction to any community? So this might be as a student going to a university becomes a member of a wider university community and has to submit to a certain code of practice, or when a person becomes a JISC project manager and needs to file their reports on time.
Fantastic. I'm just going to ask you one more question to wrap up now, because I can see we've got another guest waiting in the studio for us. And it's about the sustainability session that you ran this afternoon.
Well, we ran a session using open space technology, a very abbreviated open space technology, I'd have to say, drawing on Harrison Owen's ideas. Open space technology is supposed to enable groups to address complex and important issues and achieve meaningful results quickly. We used Web2 technologies. We threw up a PB wiki, put out the plan, tried to organize the groups, and we came up with a number of themes or ideas that need to be taken forward. So.
And that planning is going into looking at whether the eMERGE actual site, how that's going to function in the future and the sustainability of it as a platform and as a broad community of practice.
Well, the site is a platform for a community. It's very easy to conflate the site with the community, but we do have to remember that the community is a network of people and the site is one representation and one shop window, if you like, for that community.
Sure.
But there's an awful lot of networking that goes on in other sites and in other venues.
And in actual real life. I think that might be a good sieg for a little dance, Joe. What did you say?
Thank you, Josie.
Thank you, George.
Okay, it's Graham Atwell back here. That was a great interview Josie just did. And I'm delighted to have Mark Van Harmelen here with me to talk about PLEs, personal learning environments. Welcome, Mark.
Hi, Graham. And hi, everyone out there.
I've been actually planning to do this talk to you about PLEs on a live show for ages to have a longer interview with you. So finally, we've got it together. Mark, I want to talk to you about two things. I mean, today you've been presenting what's now known as the Manchester Personal Learning Environment. But I wanted to talk to you about that in a moment. But first, I'd like to talk to you a bit more about PLEs in general. Because, look, it's been 4 years, 5 years now since we came up with the idea of personal learning environments. How far do you think we've got?
I think that there's been a general raising of consciousness. My own interest in the PLE movement has been one of encouraging a movement towards learner control. Learner control of their own education and realization of their educational goals. And I think that hand in hand with Web 2 and the use of Web 2 tools, there's a general movement towards that kind of result.
Yeah, and it was very encouraging at the Evolve event in Manchester, a fantastic presentation from research from people from Portugal who are moving their entire campus over to social software applications from September.
Yeah, that's really great. And they're building on top of certain Portuguese services which are available on the web and currently at a prototype stage. But it'll be great to see a whole university working in that direction.
What are the barriers, do you think, to the introduction of personal learning environments?
I would say entrenched institutional attitudes. We've got this existing course or module, and we've taught it like this for the last 3 years, and there's going to be effort and thought and blood and sweat and tears involved in moving into a different kind of framework where the learners are actually more in control of what they do and what they learn.
And I suppose that builds a bit on what George was saying in the last interview. We're back into the change agenda. I've been around, done a fair few presentations on personal learning environments, and always people come up to me afterwards and say, Graham, we loved it. We love your ideas. We think it's brilliant. We want PLEs, but how are we going to get past our institutional bosses that is challenging their power?
I think just do things. If you see an opportunity to do something, if you believe in doing it, then grab whatever tools you can and just do it. I've done that kind of thing in courses
before. Edupunk.
And it works.
Yes, it is edupunk, isn't it? It is that attitude of doing it. But, of course, there are real issues involved.
Certainly, assessment, meeting institutional aims and standards for courses and so on, these kind of activities have to be quite carefully managed in order to make sure that you don't run foul of existing structures and strictures.
Absolutely. Let's move onwards then. I suppose the other issue which frequently gets raised is the idea of, is a PLE an idea? Is it a pedagogy? Is it a software application? Is it all three? What's your view?
I think that PLEs as ideas have, or concepts have come about by, well, the idea that you can take a whole bunch of tools and assemble them to produce something which meets personal learning needs. And as such, it's quite hard to grasp onto a single thing or a single set of tools and say, okay, this is my PLE. So the idea of a PLE as a concept has arisen, but a PLE could be a system as well. However, I'd like to just kind of sidestep all of that and say the important thing is the PLE movement's inherent notion that learners can and should take control of their own learning aims.
That sounds cool. Well, I suppose that moves us on to you've been involved in trying to develop a PLE, which I now say here is called the Manchester PLE.
Well, we called it the PLE, but we thought that was probably a bit all-encompassing and cheeky, so qualifying it and calling it the Manchester PLE seems to be a good idea. It did originate at the University of Manchester. A bunch of students and I got together and produced the first prototype, and since then we've had various bits of funding from the Emerge community, which has pushed things forward, and then more recently larger funding from the JISC to develop this in conjunction with various Library 2.0 facilities. We're almost at a stage where it's going to be releasable to the world. We expect to have a usable prototype in fact, 1 week.
In 1 week, yes. Oh, that's impressive. So, once more, people are saying, well, we've got all these social software tools. People are saying, I can assemble my own PLE. I can put together Digo, I can put together a wiki, I can put together a blog. So, why an application?
Well, this grab all these tools and use them is great if you're web literate, but many people aren't web literate, and it's those kinds of people who I want to appeal to with an integrated set of tools. With an integrated set of tools, you can also do more in terms of getting one piece of your selection of sub-tools, so to speak, to work better with other selections.
Then who do you see providing the PLE? Because I can see some issues here. If it's the institution telling the students they got to use it, is that a PLE?
Yes. I mean, if you're an anarchist, can you promote anarchy?
I'm not sure that was the question, Mark.
No, but
it's a rather good sidestep.
It's a similar question, isn't it? Institutions can provide tools for learners to use, and I think one of the things about integrated PLEs, the kind of tool which we've been building, is how can they be extended, how can they be knitted into the rest of the web fabric, and we have got certain takes on that because we've been thinking about that for some time. So institutions can provide them. We are going to do this as a kind of community effort as well, put a server on the web and see who comes along and uses it, probably in a beta trial mode first of all. Institutions are often very concerned about ownership of data and keeping students' data carefully, protecting students, so keeping students' data within the institution. And I think that's a good thing. So it's not really a retrograde step for an institution to provide a PLE.
Well, I'm not sure it's a retrograde step, but I'm still back to this control aspect. A personal learning environment is what it says. It's personal. Now, are you saying you're going to be telling students you can't use your own tools to create your own personal learning environment? You've got to use the Manchester PLE.
Graham pushing the boundaries as normal.
And someone's just passed, Joseph's just passed Mark a quick glass of beer here.
Basically, look, let me sidestep that again. I want to I want to break the kind of central control that VLEs impose upon institutions and people studying inside institutions. And I'd like to give students inside institutions facilities so that they can choose their own learning goals. I think that's the important thing, and chase down their learning goals and mutate what they want to learn about as well.
We're running a bit short of time, but can you just briefly give us a rundown what the PLE would do for those people who are listening who might be interested in trying it?
Oh, the Manchester PLE, okay. It's got a social software layer because people learn well in groups. So we like to be able to facilitate group activities. And on top of that social software layer, we have got multi-user, multimedia spaces, which if you're a techie are implemented in Flash, but if you're not a techie, forget about that. But these are repurposable spaces in which you can import or use learning plans and mutate those learning plans to reflect your own aims, and then mutate them further to make explicit the knowledge which you have gained as a learner. You'll be able to help your co-learners in those spaces and elsewhere in the social software substrate, and be able to produce artifacts which are visible by others and which will help others in their learning activities. I think trying it is probably the best thing to do.
Well, that's what I was going to say. And people who do want to try it, how can they?
Well, they could email me, and my email is easily findable via Google, but otherwise, markvanharmelen@gmail.com.
And we'll put a link to that on the websites accompanying on the Emerge site, where this broadcast will be available in podcast version tomorrow. Thanks, Mark. Great having you on the programme tonight.
Pleasure. Thank you, Graham.
Okay, everyone. We're going to go into another short musical break, and we're going to be back on with Josie Fraser talking to Nicola Whitten and Rosie Jones on what?
On alternate reality gaming.
Alternate reality gaming can't be bad. So just stay in there while Joe spins the discs and gives us a short musical break.
From that little dancing interlude that we had. We all enjoyed a little dance around the studio there. I hope you guys enjoyed it too. I'm really happy to have two fantastic women along on the show tonight, Nicola Whitten and Rosie Jones. These two guys nearly drove me insane last week at a conference where I took part in one of their alternate reality games, and it was fiendishly hard, fiendishly hard. It's maybe a form of student cruelty even. So to kick us off, would one of you like to tell us what is an alternative reality game?
Okay, I'll go for that. I've done this hopefully enough times to have got this off pat. But what it really comprises are three different elements. It's a relatively new form of gaming, probably been around since about 2001. And the first types of alternate reality games that came about were viral marketing to support books and films and music. There are three main elements to them. The first being this idea of a narrative that runs over a set period of time, be that a couple of hours, a couple of weeks, several months. There's the idea of a self-sustaining community that builds on the narrative and works together to solve puzzles and challenges, which is the third element. And as they solve the puzzles and challenges and build artifacts and build their own storyline and community, they manage to achieve whatever the aim of the game is.
Okay, that's quite a comprehensive introduction there. So hopefully all of our listeners will be crystal clear now on what they were. And you guys were here again. An evil laugh. You see, these are evil women. And you guys were delivering a game again today. How did that go?
It actually went really well. It wasn't so much the game today. We delivered a bit of the concept of the game, and then we really kind of brought it over to the audience to, well, give us input in a way. So we actually pinched and completely stole their ideas today of how they might actually use an ARG and how they might motivate students to use an ARG as well. So they only really experienced an aspect of the ARG because of the time restrictions we had today, but I think everybody got the concept. And I think that's probably the most important thing with an ARG, is actually to play it. You don't really get the concept unless you actually play the game.
Okay, and what games have you been working on recently?
Well, for me, it's just Argosy. I got kidnapped onto this game by Nicholas. So
your involvement is actually part of the game.
Yes. So that's my main involvement, really, is Argosy itself. Nicholas got a lot more experience.
One of the things, we ran Argosy as a live pilot from September through till December last year. And some of it worked and some of it didn't. And I think we learned a lot from doing that. But what we're hoping to do, Rosie informed me a few days ago, is the library liked it enough to actually be able to take it and run with it next year. One of the big problems that we had last year is that we thought it'd be a great idea to launch it in Freshers Week, because it was an alternate reality game to support student induction, which of course is a time when students have 101 other things, mainly pub-related, thrust at them. What we're planning to do next year, and Rosie will be able to tell you a bit more about this.
Is that put a pub element into the game?
Put a Pavel, surely not. No, I certainly couldn't condone anything of that type. But the idea is to start getting students involved prior to registration, so that they could be meeting people that they're going to be at university with, doing stuff with them online, building up the online community, and as soon as they get to Manchester, they can actually meet them face-to-face to go to whatever locale suits them.
So using the alternative reality game format to build community prior to them arriving, develop those kind of links to help them over that period.
Exactly, rather than waiting until they get there when they have this complete information overload.
Okay, I'll just wrap up, ask you one more question about what you think is, what excites you in the world of alternative reality gaming at the moment? What kind of, where do your interests lie?
I think there's a lot of really exciting stuff happening. There's a couple or three big ones that came last year around using alternate reality game for charity campaigning, getting messages and for fundraising. There was a brilliant one called Operation Sleeper Cell that was headed up by Juliet Culver at who's based at the Open University.
Is that Juliet Culver at the Open University?
It is indeed, yes.
Juliet Culver at the Open University.
I hope she's listening and can notice the plug. But they've done some amazing work there around in association with cancer research. And the whole movement for using alternate reality game, both for education and for charities, I think it's really growing, lots of potential there.
Fantastic. Thank you very much, ladies. Really great to have you along. And I'll see you soon.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, it's into a musical break.
Bretzel avalé de travers aurait pu être salutaire pour des milliers de gens. Je roule une dernière cigarette. Demain, promis juré, j'arrête. De toute façon, je n'aurai plus de tête. Dans le couloir de la mort, j'attends.
Okay, welcome back. It's Graham Atwell here again. You're listening to Emerging Sounds of the Bizarre. Emerge Sounds of the Bizarre. Live internet radio. Live on the radio. Live on the internet. And today it's live from Loughborough with a great range of studio guests. Emerging Sounds of the Bizarre. Okay, I'm delighted to have Bob Rotherham here today. We're going to talk about the Sounds Good project. I heard you do a presentation at Alt-C last year about it, didn't I?
Yes, I think you did.
It was a great session. Tell us about the project.
Sounds Good is about using audio, digital audio, to give feedback on students' coursework. Quite closely focused programme, funded by JISC. I've been a member of the Users and Innovation programme, and it's gone very, very well. What else can I tell you, Graham?
Well, you can tell me how the project works, what you do, what did you develop? You had a project. You must have done something, I suppose, for the money.
The way that the project was conceived was, it's based at Leeds Met, where I work, and we had in the first phase of the project, it was just short term, 6 months. We had 15 members of staff who were experimenting with using digital audio to give feedback on students' coursework.
So how did that work?
The staff would have a bunch of marking to do, you know, typical student assignments, and they would do it in their own ways, but one element of the feedback would be done via audio rather than, as is traditional, by writing it.
So they put the audio onto a website, gave them on a disc?
The audio was done as MP3 files, because MP3 files are, they're relatively small, quality for quality. They're a lot smaller than WAV files, for instance. And also they're playable on more or less any kind of device. So once recorded, they were sent to students in 2-3 ways. One was as an email attachment. Another was into the virtual learning environment, into a student's individual space within the virtual learning environment. And then just, there was a little bit of experimentation was done, sending stuff to a few students' mobile devices. We've got the Assessment and Learning in Practice Settings, ALPS Settle at Leeds Met, which had bought quite a lot of PDAs, which were being used by students on placement. And we decided to piggyback on that equipment and send a few of bits of audio feedback to students who were on placement. But mainly, it was via email and also into the virtual learning environment.
Okay, so I've got the idea now. The students submit some work normally,
yeah,
and instead of writing comments and then, yeah, sending the document back, they get an audio file back with the comments. Let's go on the pedagogic side then. What's different about it? How does it change moving from the written form to the oral form of feedback?
Right. I think step back a little bit before, okay, I come to the pedagogy, okay, of it. Why bother with this project? Yeah. Where it started was it's about 3 years ago now, when I was doing some marking myself for a postgraduate programme. The norm on that programme was to give quite a lot of feedback. A typical assignment would attract maybe 500 words of written feedback. It would take me quite a long time to produce that. And I thought, well, can I save some time on this? And I read a paper by Chris Rust at Oxford Brookes University, who was recommending using audio. Paper written in 2001, recommending using the technology of the time, which was audio cassettes. A bit clunky. Sounded a good idea, though, but it hadn't really taken off. Would digital audio be any better? Is it easier to use? Is it easier to send stuff around? So I had a go with it using Audacity software. And I found that after just a few goes at this, I was saving myself time. Quite an advantage for a lecturer. Sent the MP3 files back to the students who were beginning lecturers themselves. They loved it. They raved about it. They wanted to use it with their own students as well. So all this is very, very encouraging. Maybe I'm onto something here. Waited for the opportunity, which came through the JISC Emerge community. Got funding for a project to tie it with 15 or so people at Leeds Met, and it's gone very well. Does it change the pedagogy? I think it does. I think using audio for feedback allows a lecturer to develop a more intimate relationship with their student than happens normally by just providing written feedback. Audio is a much richer medium than written text is. It's got all sorts of non-verbal communication in there. The students can tell immediately whether the lecturer is interested in them, whether they're serious, whether they're having a joke.
Or if they're not interested in them.
What are the really important points to take note of, what can be brushed off, and so on. And our consistent experience through this project is that the students really do like getting audio feedback.
That's really interesting. I mean, I'm wondering as well whether, because I've been looking at a move from summative assessment to far more formative assessment, yeah, which is the way we've got to go. And it just occurring to me that audio may be verbal, oral feedback may give you a far more formative medium than traditional written stuff.
Sure. I've become aware of the potential for digital audio to be used in so many different ways, but yes, certainly for formative feedback as well as summative. On the Sounds Good project, we've done both. My original concept for the design for the project was to try to focus on a piece of work where there was the possibility of doing both formative and summative, you know, a piece of work which would take students several weeks to prepare, and at the interim stage there would be an opportunity to submit a draft for formative feedback and then later for formal submission for summative feedback. That happened in some instances, but I went with the flow, and sometimes it was just one round of summative feedback. Sometimes, well, there was more than two on occasion. So we've tried different things, and I would agree with your suggestion, Graham, that formative feedback is more than possible with digital audio. It works very well. Students do like it. It's very enabling for the students, you know, to be able to plan their work. And in some circumstances, it's feasible for lecturers to do it. Sometimes providing formative feedback is extra work. They might not do it conventionally in writing. So it is sometimes an extra activity. You've got to be careful with people's time. But in some circumstances, it is feasible to do it.
So we've got a project here which the students like, the lecturers like it, it saves time, by implication the institution should like it because it saves money. You've got a success on your hands. What's the problems? What's the downside? Well, there's always a but somewhere.
There is a but. I have not said during this interview that using audio for feedback actually does save you time. I've said
you did at the beginning.
That was my experience in certain carefully defined circumstances.
A carefully worded man here.
Yeah. People's experience has been variable. A few have said that quite quickly they're saving time. A number have said it takes me about the same time as my traditional methods. And some have said this is taking me more time. But pretty well all the people, all the staff who've been involved with the project are saying this gives a better service to students. And even if it's taking me more time, I want to stick with this, I'm on with something. Whether or not a lecturer is likely to save time by giving audio feedback depends on a number of variables. And amongst them, we've identified so far, are you're more likely to save time if you give a lot of feedback. You know, it's quicker to say a lot of words than it is to write a lot of words.
Yeah.
You're more likely to save time if you are familiar with the technology. It's transparent to you. You're used to it. It's not an obstacle. Okay. You're more likely to save time also if you are a relatively slow writer, like what I am, and you can speak fairly confidently and fluently.
Like what you are.
Some of the time. So, you know, for some of our staff experienced those conditions and some didn't.
So I've got to say, I mean, you do seem to have a pretty successful project, and the gossip on the grapevine is people like this one. What next? Where are you going now with it?
Well, we've still got, if I could explain, Sounds Good went from a 6-month project to become a 12-month project. We got a bit more funding from JISC to extend it, deepen it at Leeds Met. Of the 15 people who were in the team to begin with, 6 volunteered to take it on to the second stage, carry on with some more audio feedback themselves, and also to recruit 2 new people. So the idea was another dozen people at Leeds Met were trying it out. And also we were introducing the project to 3 other institutions. And we've involved Newman University College in Birmingham, University of Northampton, and York St John University. They've started to use audio feedback as well, and it's gone very well there as well. Their students love it, their staff like it as well. So that's what we've been doing in the last 6 months, and that's what I'm writing up at the moment for the deadline for the report at the end of March.
The dreaded report.
That's right, yes.
But we can hope that we see this going on now?
I think so, yes. Even without funding, I think it's got a life of its own now. My colleagues do like it, as I say, and they are minded to use it. The students like it too. That will generate pressures of its own as well. It may well be that some colleagues come under a little bit of pressure from students. Well, he's doing it down the corridor, so why don't you?
That's a damn good change factor. I just have to say, I love that phrase, minded to use it. I think we could adopt that as a slogan for a lot of our projects. They're minded to use it.
Yeah. We've not cracked all the problems. There are some issues still. There are some of the staff who've tried it who have, they are definitely not saving time and their patience is being tried. It's proved the most difficult for those who've got very large modules, 100 plus students. They're finding themselves with a lot of work. The big problem for them is once they've created the audio files, how to get them back economically to the students. It's quite laborious at the moment at Leeds Met and in the other, most of the other institutions to do with the project, to ensure that this particular numbered file gets back to the student with that ID and that no mistakes are made.
Well, I think let's chuck that out to a challenge then to people listening to this programme. If you've got bright ideas on that one, think about it.
We want to be able to automate this process. I did have it half in mind when Sounds Good 2 started. Could I hire a programmer to develop some routine that would automate this for us? We didn't get round to it. It's a job that remains to be done.
So here we are. Here's a emerging Sounds of the Bazaar challenge to you out there. How can you automate that process of getting the audio feedback back? Has anyone got any software? Anyone got any bright ideas? Anyone got any funding? Come back to us. We're going to have to wind up this interview now because we've got to move on. But Bob, if people want to find out more about the project, where can they find it?
Where they can find it? Well, if you Google Sounds Good, that's the easiest way.
Damn good one to Google on. Sounds Good is a great project. Thanks very much for coming and talking to us today. And I hope we see more of this project and I really hope it will move in the future. Okay, we're going to go into a musical break, and then it's going to be me and Josie, and it's a surprise item for you. I'm going to be telling you about the future of Sounds of the Bazaar. And we're back now live, back here with Josie. This is the closing moment of the programme. And it's a bit sad, Josie, because actually this is the last in the series of Emerging Sounds of the Bazaar. Of course, the Emerge programme comes to an end at the end of March.
I know. Along the way, there's been tears, there's been laughter. I think we've all learnt some important lessons.
There's going to be a beer or two tonight, I tell you.
There will be a beer or two tonight. Yes, it's definitely something to celebrate. It's very, very sad that the programme's coming to an end, but I'm extremely proud of all of the things that the projects have achieved so far. I'm very excited.
We only scraped the barrel with the ones we've been able to present here, haven't we?
Oh, we've barely touched the sides, Graham. Barely touched the sides. I'm very excited about what's going to happen next with the projects, with the connections that they've all made with each other, with the platform going on. I think it's a really exciting time.
Yes, I think so. I mean, it's not an end at all. I mean, I'm seeing this going forward. And I suppose that brings us to Sounds of the Bazaar, doesn't it? Well, we've actually been running now with Sounds of the Bazaar and podcast and a live version now for 3 years. And we started out being sponsored by the European Commission through the Bazaar Project, which is where the name came from. Then we had some sponsorship from Online Educare Berlin. And then we moved into the present series, which has been sponsored by Emerge. And by the Users Innovation Programme. And look, I mean, there's a lot of interest. We've got a lot of people interested in the programmes. We're certainly not going to go away. How we're sort of thinking at the moment is that Sounds of the Bazaar will become more of a channel than a programme, we will continue to produce our slightly irreverent version of sounds.
Only very slightly irreverent.
Only very slightly. We'll move under the sponsorship of Pontedusky, but we're hoping to introduce new programmes into the channel. We've got an exciting pilot edition being commissioned. I don't think I can reveal quite who by at the moment, but that will be going out hopefully in April. We'll be bringing out a new programme, I think I can say this, for the e-learning programme as a pilot. And we've got other people interested. If you're interested in either sponsoring us to produce programmes, or you're interested in us training you to produce programmes, or you're interested in producing programmes yourself and putting them out through our channel, we'd be delighted to hear from you. The one thing we can offer you is a lot of fun, some knowledge about the technologies, although sometimes you laugh if you see us sweating before we go out. We've got to know a little bit, I suppose, about what works and doesn't. And we've critically got bandwidth at the moment. And that's probably the biggest technical thing you need. You actually need a microphone, a computer, and a few cables, and a willingness to mess around. But you do need bandwidth, and we can offer anyone who's listening free bandwidth for up to 200 listeners to listen live at any one time. So just get in touch. So Sounds of the Bazaar, the emerging Sounds of the Bazaar, the end of this series, but Sounds of the Bazaar will go on, just as I'm sure many of these projects that we've been talking about today are going to continue.
I'm sure they will, and I'm sure Graham and I will be back before you know it.
Before you know it, indeed.
Before you've had a chance to miss us, even.
That's what we hope. Okay, this is Graham Atwell and
Josie Fraser
saying goodnight to you from live at Loughborough, emerging
Sounds of the Bazaar.
Sounds of the Bazaar was produced and directed by Pontedusky for the GISC Users Innovation Emerge project. Sounds of the Bazaar was presented by Graham Atwell and Josie Fraser. Music was by the Drunk Souls from the On Verra Putard album, available on the Amendo website. All materials licensed under Creative Commons 3 license.